You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many immigrants come to the United States with big dreams of success and fortune. For Slava Gelman, the protagonist of Boris Fishman's darkly funny novel, these dreams have so far gone unfulfilled. Slava wants to become a famous writer, but when he finds himself in a dead-end job with no prospects, he makes a decision that blurs his notions of truth and honor in order to make it big. A Replacement Life, which explores themes of loyalty, morality, and history, and asks the sorts of questions that don't have easy answers, is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased that it brings Boris Fishman back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. I'm pleased in turn to be here.
Isn't this novel based somewhat on your experiences? You were born in the former Soviet Union, immigrated to the United States at 9, and your grandmother survived the Minsk ghetto.
That is absolutely true. My grandmother was a survivor. And as you may know, people behind the Iron Curtain were not eligible to apply for restitution. They were excluded from the agreements because it was felt by the people who arrived at those agreements that the money would be poached by the Soviet government, which was probably a reasonable thing to be concerned about. So she didn't become eligible until we got here in the late 80s. And so she got her paperwork in the 90s. And at this point, I'm all of 15 or 16. But I have the best English in the family because I'm the youngest. And so all this is given to me. And so I filled it out with her.
And then many years later, thinking about that experience, you got an idea about writing a novel?
It started right then. The thing that struck me about the paperwork, the burden of proof was really low. For obvious reasons, you weren't given a receipt when you went into the Minsk ghetto. And so this matter of the historical record became a matter of storytelling, came down to, could you tell a persuasive story? And for an aspiring writer, that was catnip, you know?
Well, this book has taken you a while to write. The last time you were here as an editor. Your character here, your protagonist, is a junior staff member at Century, which is a magazine. Sounds a lot like The New Yorker. he wants to be a famous writer, and he is not going to make it there. Did you ever work at a magazine like The New Yorker?
I worked at The New Yorker.
Ah.
But Century Magazine is not a replica of The New Yorker.
Oh, it seems stuffier.
Yeah, it's different in quite a few ways. And, you know, some people, it's interesting what people read into it. Some say it's sillier. You just said it's stuffier. It's interesting for me to hear all that. It really is a composite portrait of all the places where I worked as a freelance journalist and contributed to. But on the writing front, what was interesting to me is that Slava was learning how to tell a story because, you know, he's hot to become a big writer at this magazine. The only problem is he doesn't know how to write very well, which explains why this magazine wants nothing from him.
And on the other hand, all the people he is talking to, the people of his grandparents' generation, have wonderful stories to tell. We'll get to that. We do hear about more about his grandparents than his parents. Is it fair to say that everything skipped a generation, or bitterness skipped a generation?
That's very true. And I learned of it myself only when the book was finished. You know, it's a really nice moment when the book reveals something to you rather than vice versa. And when I was done with the first draft, and there were 12, by the way, there were 11 more to go.
That's why it took so many years.
Yeah, it took quite a while. But one of the amazing things that I realized is the parents are nowhere in this book. And some of the people who read it suggested that I put them in for balance. But I realized it's not their story. The conversation has been between the grandchildren and the grandparents, precisely because the stories are with the grandparents.
And Slava seems to define himself against his grandfather, Yevgeny.
That's the yardstick. The thing that I think about now to move to me as the author is I think about my grandparents' generation and what they went through. And I think about our parents' generation, not mine because we're from the Soviet Union, but America's talking about Vietnam. And then I think about my generation comparatively. What are we known for? Facebook, you know?
What sets this whole thing in motion is when Slava's grandmother, who was a survivor of the Minsk ghetto, receives a letter from the Conference on Material Claims Against Germany inviting her to apply for reparations from the German government. Unlike your story, she is no longer alive.
That's absolutely right. There are all these key moments where sort of the narrative departs quite dramatically from what happened in real life. But it's because she went before Slava ever had a chance to get to know her that he's enticed by this opportunity to recreate her on the page.
In your case, in speaking, often older people don't want to tell their stories, especially the bad stories. Did this give you access to things you might not have heard about otherwise?
Well, that's true. My grandmother, my real-life grandmother, did not want to tell me her stories. I tricked her into it. What happened when I asked
her... Well, she had to tell you for the restitution forms, didn't she?
That's right. That's right. But even before that, when I approached her and asked her what any of it was like, because it was this great undiscussed secret in our family, she would say, "I don't want to upset you," which really meant, "I don't want to upset me." And so what I did is I told her that I had a school assignment for history class, personal narratives going back three generations. One thing my grandmother wouldn't have dared is cost me a good grade. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got her to start talking even before this paperwork came through.
In the novel, as I said, the grandmother has died, which leads Slava's grandfather, Evgeny, to pressure him into forging a restitution claim for him.
That's right.
Now, he has no reason to make the claim, but he says that he has suffered anyway to qualify for restitution because he was a Jew in the war. He was a second-class citizen in the USSR, and then he lived as an immigrant in the United States.
He thinks he very much has a reason. What do you do if you've suffered at the through no fault of your own your entire life because you were unlucky enough? I was lucky enough to have been brought to America at the age of 9. I never had to answer questions that my elders had to answer as Jews in the Soviet Union, which was indeed a second-class life. If you had endured that for 6-7 decades, and you finally get to a place where someone is offering, not for what you went through, but you went through enough all the same, what do you do?
On the other hand, when Slava resists, Yevgeny argues, this country does not invent things. When the stocks fall down, it's not because someone invented the numbers?
Precisely. Someone, for me, no matter how many exceptions you want to invoke, America is a much fairer country, and this system, for all its flaws, is much fairer and much more trusting of and generous toward its citizens than my former homeland ever was. However, if you want to find examples of people abusing power, there are plenty of them here.
Did your grandparents actually feel that they had been discriminated against because they were Jewish? Didn't everybody feel a bit oppressed in the Soviet Union except the people who were part of the system?
No, quite the contrary. It really was a second-class life. I'll tell you a quick story. I mean, there were quotas, undeclared quotas on Jews being admitted to universities. And I don't know what it was, 5 per thousand, 10 per thousand. And then my mother went and became valedictorian. But it was unseemly to have a Jew at the top if we admitted so few. And so they demoted her to salutatorian. And my grandfather, my real-life grandfather, had to bribe the Minister of Education for Belarus in order for him to do the right thing.
Now, Belarus is a separate country, considered the last of the total dictatorships of Europe. Have you gone back?
I went back once. The yard in front of my childhood apartment building was half as large as I remembered it. And it wasn't my home anymore. And I stayed for only 2 days.
Well, I remember as a kid hearing all these jokes about people going from Minsk to Pinsk.
Pinsk, indeed. From Omsk to Tomsk.
Yevgeny, the grandfather in the story, spreads the news around the South Brooklyn neighborhood that Slava can write these wonderful, fictitious Holocaust restitution claims. And he winds up having to decide whether that's going to be his new writing career.
That's right. What do you do if you get everything you wanted except absolutely in the wrong arena?
But he does get to hear incredible stories and then has to decide how much has been embellished. So this is really also not just about fiction being invented, but fact being invented.
That was really important for me to explore in the novel, because when we pick up biographies, memoirs, it's our inclination to assume, mine as well, that, oh, this really happened exactly like this. But of course not. that's stitched together and interpreted. One of the things I really wanted to do with the novel was remind readers how much nonfiction is actually fictionalized and how much fiction is actually hews quite closely to what actually happened.
Slava has moved away from Soviet Brooklyn to the Upper East Side, a way of separating himself from all of this?
Well, it's a really callow maneuver. I mean, Slava's in his mid-20s, and it's something that only a 20-year-old would think, a 20-something-year-old would think would solve the problem. Slava doesn't yet realize that you take your brain with you wherever you go. And so he runs away from South Brooklyn, settles in Manhattan, and just waits for the Americanness to take hold. And, of course, it doesn't.
And that, of course, includes working at this magazine, Century Magazine, which is the most American of all magazines.
If you're at Century, you've made it. But why doesn't he feel like he's made it?
Well, the freedom to write is part of the American dream for Slava, but he ends up becoming the forger of South Brooklyn for these restitution claims. There's a certain amount of irony in the fact that he sets out to be a journalist whose job is to respect facts, discover the truth, and ends up forging legal documents.
One of the great freedoms of this book, both for Slava and for me, is that if you don't have real-life history, as Slava does not with his grandmother because she passed away before he could get to know her, not all is lost. You can write it. For better and for worse, you can write what happened.
From kasha to caviar, the grandparents are often associated with food. How do you see food as reflecting the transition of Soviet Russian Jews to America?
Food is a weapon. Food is a brow-beating weapon used by the older generation.
Well,
I like
kasha, and I like caviar, and I was born here.
As do I. There's a kind of rhapsodic, or at least it was rhapsodic for me to write, paragraph in the novel where Slava just goes on for 10, 12 to 15 lines listing all the dishes that he gets to eat at his grandfather's house.
We have a number of writers who have written about that transition from Russia to the United States and some of the things that they still find more attractive from Russia, although they would never go back. People like Gary Steingarten, Lara Vapniar. Do you see yourself as part of a group of writers who are dealing with this kind of subject matter?
It would be absolutely wrong for me to speak for any of them, but I'm going to speak for any of them, for all of them, when I say I think each of us would want to be read on our own merits, not because it's so important to be seen as somehow different, but because when I read these people, I see each of them doing something different. The only binding element is this community. And if you have only local color, well, it's not enough. You need a real story and real art. And I think you find a different kind of it in each of these books.
Although there's been this tendency for critics to put people together, Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and Bernard Malamud, for example, or all of these Mexican-American writers who have been grouped together.
Sure.
So there's no way out of it. On the other hand, I guess the attempt you have to make is to not sound like the others.
You know, the thing that I desire greatly is to connect with readers. And if this classification gets them to pick up the book, I would be more than happy, because I know the conversation we're going to have about it at the end of the line will be quite specific.
Well, one of the things you have in common with someone like Gary Steingarten is you both write very funny.
Yes.
You see the humor in some of these really dark things.
That's absolutely true. And you're not crying unless you're laughing with these people. And you're not laughing unless you're crying. You better be doing both at the same time. And Gary understands that very well as well. But one thing that was really important for me to bring across is also how much sadness, grief, shame, vanity, love, generosity, confusion, desperation, all these less easy, less handsome emotions, how much they are a part of that communal profile as well.
Are you working on another novel or more short stories?
I actually just finished my second. I just put it to bed a couple of weeks ago. It's called Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo.
The title of this book is A Replacement Life, which leaves the reader wondering, what are you suggesting is being replaced?
When you immigrate, you replace a life. When you follow or don't follow in your elder's footsteps, you replace a life. When you change yourself, you replace a life. When you write the grandmother that you never got to know, you replace a life. Everything is replaced and unreplaced.
And when you write a false document about things
precisely
that kind of happened but didn't really happen, that's also a replacement.
Indeed.
A Replacement Life is has gotten great reviews. Congratulations.
Thank you on that.
It is published by Harper. And Boris Fishman, thank you so much for being on our show again.
It was great to be here once again. Thank you, Leonard.